booked the job, I feel like I must not have known exactly what the whole script was about when I took the audition. In any case, when it all came to light, I decided to pass on it, which was a first, but even for pretend, I didn't want to beat a kid's face in. Let somebody else spend his day doing that. It was really hard to learn that I didn't have to accept every job offered. A lot of early hopes were placed in the TV pilot basket. To roll the dice on a pilot and hope you might land on a Will and Grace or a Friends or an ER or an NYPD Blue. A great show that would pay you really well for 8 years. So I was tickled when I got this pilot, Secret Service, until they suddenly said to me, "Oh, if this series goes, it's shooting in Toronto." And Megan was like, "Excuse me? Yo, buddy, what the fuck just happened?" We were just starting to set up house with each other, and a move to Toronto was not in the cards. Thankfully, everything pointed to the show not going. I really liked the people involved, but it was honestly pretty embarrassing. It was peopled by Fox's flavor of actors circa 2001, which basically meant models playing Secret Service agents. I was the only one who could have remotely passed as a Secret Service agent, and I would have been a tiny Secret Service agent. I'm 5'10½" and maybe 200 pounds, which on this Fox show made me the fat guy. This was a great example of how real life can unexpectedly supersede casting dreams. I finally won the actor lottery and booked a pilot, and because of the love in my life, I didn't want it to go to series. I continued to describe myself as a slowly rolling snowball. I was still getting TV jobs, as I had become good friends with a lot of the Will and Grace writers, who were some of the best comedy writers working. A couple of them ended up gratifyingly writing me parts in new pilots they were working on. One of them wrote a new pilot and wrote me a very specific and hilarious series regular role on his show. I went through the audition process, which was kind of a cakewalk for once because it was written specifically for my particular sense of humor. The part was a weird Navy intelligence guy in D.C. I don't usually have my mustache. I know people now know me with my mustache, but clean-shaven at the time, I thought, this guy should have a kick-ass mustache. So I was sporting some fresh new whiskers, as I am wont to do, and I cruised all the way to the final network test to get the job, which was for CBS. I arrived at the test, and there were some other great actors there whom I knew, but I thought, I got this. There's nobody here like me, and it was written for me. I did the audition, and reportedly, Les Moonves, the head of CBS, said after I left the room, "This guy's good, okay, but you know, I'm not really feeling the mustache this year." And my friend, the writer, said, "Okay, he could shave it." Les replied, "Well, we've got a couple of weeks left before we need to cast this part, so let's just see if we can get someone with a little more juice." That is an exact quote. Network executives like to throw around terms like juice and heat. 8 days later, they gave the part to an actor apparently dripping with the stuff, Mr. James Vanderbeek. That's right, gentle listener, it was Dawson from Dawson's Creek. So we've come full circle once again. Hakuna Matata. I was getting these nice shots at success with some frequency, but I was consistently losing to douchebag corporate decision-making like that. I have nothing bad to say about Mr. Vanderbeek, who does fine work. But when a comedy role written for me is handed to a heartthrob from a young adult soap opera on the WB, a very different type than myself is what I'm driving at, I'm going to find that upsetting. I don't care if it's James Vanderbeek or Ryan Gosling or Anthony Hopkins. But that's the business. For the record, I have lost no jobs to Gosling or Hopkins. Yet. Eventually, one learns that many of the jobs for which one is rejected turn out to be incredibly bad experiences in one way or another anyway, which allows one to be more unaffected by the guys who don't feel like a mustache this year. So, I continued to plug away. I was getting good parts in delicious Sundance movies, also known as really intelligent independent films. I was becoming slightly more known around town as a dependable character actor, and that went a long way towards supporting my artistic morale. I was able to maintain my confidence thanks to little signals here and there from the universe. One evening, Megan and I were strolling along the beach in Malibu, enjoying the tickling of our toes in the surf, when we unexpectedly happened upon none other than Gary Shandling. He and Megan exchanged greetings, having been previously acquainted, before she introduced me to him. I was, and am, a very big fan of his, so I was hanging back a bit. When I stepped forward to shake hands, ankle deep in the gentle Pacific swell, Gary looked piercingly into my face and asked if I was in the business. I replied that I aspired to be so, and he said, "Stick around. You've got something." Such random moments of generous magic would feed me through months and years of artistic starvation. Whenever I would even begin to think about changing paths, Shandling would appear in my mind's eye, reassuring me to stay the course. I went to an audition for Deadwood and met David Milch. After reading the delectable script, I literally said to him, "Where the fuck have you been? I've been looking for this show for my whole life." We got along, and I got this really great part in the second episode of the series. Unfortunately, I got killed by Wild Bill. Spoiler alert, he shot me in the belly at the end of the episode. Still, to this day, it's one of the best dramatic items I have on my actor's reel. That moment in Milch's embrace fed me for 5 years. Receiving the approbation of an artist of his ilk went a long way toward bolstering my persistence. Around this point, something started to seem weird to me. I was reading for a lot of dramatic stuff, but not much comedy. As a theater actor, one generally engages in whatever's in the season that year. You'll do a Shakespeare, you'll do a Sam Shepard, then you do a Phaedo farce, then some August Wilson, or Martin McDonagh. You're facile. I love doing comedy as much as I love drama and everything in between, but it began to dawn on me more and more that people really want to compartmentalize you in Los Angeles. They want you to be a specialist. They want you to do comedy or play tennis or speak French, but they don't want you to do all three. I started griping to my agents. I should mention that right around the time I met Megan, I moved to a slightly bigger agency, the redoubtable Silver Massetti and Zatmary, and I started griping to them. "Ben Stiller just did this movie with all these weird, funny male models. I never even heard about an audition. This other movie was all firemen. There wasn't one guy out of 37 firemen that I could audition for?" Just as I was starting to grouse in earnest, I ended up landing a part on the George Lopez sitcom. A great director named John Pasquin cast me on George Lopez as Randy, which was a little bit of a leap of faith since I didn't really have the character nailed down. He and I played around with it on set, and he even had me try it with an Irish dialect for fun with a touch of the leprechaun. We finally dialed it in with this silly sort of bombastic dumb guy voice. On the show, I was dating and then got engaged to the great Belita Marino, who was playing George's mom, Benny. Randy was this much younger, weird trucker type who was really silly and great fun. I ended up recurring for a couple of seasons and had an absolute blast with the good people over there. Coincidentally, Sandra Bullock was one of the executive producers on that show, and I'd known her for a couple of years because she's old friends with Courtney Valenti, Pat Roberts' wife. She was in their wedding party, as was I, and we had run into each other over the years socially. I had done a small role in her movie Murder by Numbers in a small cop scene that got cut down to an even hilariously smaller appearance. Up close, it's easy to see why she's such a success. Because she's always having fun. She did an episode of Lopez as my obsessive ex-girlfriend who was also blind. We ended up doing this really hilarious episode together that had a bunch of clowning and physical comedy in it, which was really a blast and felt like another few rotations of the snowball. A short while later, she and John Pasquin were doing a movie called Miss Congeniality 2, Armed and Fabulous, and they were trying to find an unknown actor, meaning cheap, to play the main bad guy. In other words, it wasn't a great enough part to spend their budget on any juice. So I had to jump through some hoops and do some auditions for the studio, but I ended up getting this part, which was incredible for me. This great guy and superior actor, Abraham Ben Ruby, was my brother, and we were your classic simple and scary thugs. We had such a gas in a bunch of scenes with William Shatner and Sandra, shooting all around Vegas, in and out of the casinos. At the end of the film, spoiler alert, Sandy ends up beating the shit out of me across the casino floor at Treasure Island. Everything about that job was a dream, but the best part was that I had won the role from my work, further solidifying my snowball. Shortly thereafter, I got a nice part in this movie Sin City that Robert Rodriguez and Frank Miller made, based on Frank's graphic novel series of the same name. This came about from a really random audition recorded on video in a room at the Four Seasons, so I never met the directors until I went to shoot it. But I think it went well because things were kind of starting to roll now. I was making a nice living as an actor, still working in TV, guest star stuff, and more small film jobs. My woodworking was going great. My work and home life made me happy, which then helped me land more and better work, which made me even more happy and confident, and so on. In 2005, I did this movie called The Go-Getter, written and directed by Martin Hines. It's such a sweet, beautiful movie, and I'm going to plug the shit out of it right here. It's one of several films I've done that went to Sundance, but apparently the timing wasn't just right, because it should have been a total hit. Premiering a film at Sundance is a huge victory in itself, by the way, especially considering that just shooting a feature film to completion and affording and surviving post-production until you have a 90-minute work of art that you're proud of, well, let's just say that a film must surmount a row of hurdles immeasurably long and high in order to even reach a movie screen in the first place. This film, The Go-Getter, has Zooey Deschanel and Lou Taylor Pucci and Jenna Malone all doing exquisite work as the beautiful young people that they are, not to mention Maura Tierney and Bill Duke in great supporting turns. I went in to read for this little part in the movie, and this is something I did a lot. If I was reading for one or two smaller scenes, like the guy at the bus stop or the guy at the hardware store or what have you, I'd go through the script and see if there was something else I could reasonably do. Then I'd go in and say, I've prepared the bus driver, as requested, and also the thug at the end with the baseball bat, if you'd care to also see me essay that role as well. At the Go-Getter, I was reading to play the shitty night manager of a shitty hotel. It was a really fun scene, and it went really well, and they were happy. I then said, I don't mean to be an asshole, but I also prepared the role of the potter. Can I try that? And Hines, the director, a bit befuddled, said, yeah, sure. In his mind, he was thinking, this audition for the night manager was the best one we've seen. I love this guy already. So when I asked about the other thing, he was a bit confused. I then fortunately did an audition for the potter that he also really loved. I left, and as he told me later, he thought, oh boy, what do? I love him for both parts. He went back and forth between the two, and finally the producer said, well, give him both parts then. I was working in my wood shop when he phoned to tell me that he wanted me to do both parts. According to him, I then said, excellent. What else you got? And he laughed and said, Everything's cast, except I need an accordion player and a trumpet player, but it's a small part, kind of non-speaking. And I said, according to Martin, I've got your accordion player, and I play a little trumpet. To which he laughingly agreed. The accordion player was Cornmo, and Martin ended up using both him and his kick-ass song Angel in the film. So I ended up with three parts in the movie, and we have remained great friends on top of it. It's a beautiful movie. You should see it tonight, preferably with a date, and I guarantee you won't be sorry. The Go-Getter, ladies and gentlemen. I had found my stride. I could go into casting sessions with confidence, knowing that my weirdness was appealing to the right people in the right way. I had cottoned that it was only going to be every 30th director or so who was going to get me, because the other 29 were looking for tits or blonde hair or fast talking, or I don't know what, juice? You just have to find the people who are on the same page as you are. To my great delight, Megan then got cast in Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein on Broadway, so we went to live in New York at the drop of a hat. I'd always wanted to live there, anyway, at least for a spell. I was frankly tickled pink. I took a bag of tools, as I knew I was going to find a shop and build my first canoe. While there, I ended up doing this movie with Ryan Gosling and Kirsten Dunst called All Good Things. It was a really interesting, cool project, directed by smarty extraordinaire Andrew Jarecki, who once again cast me off of a videotaped audition. I am still awfully grateful for the continued votes of confidence like that which kept me in the game. A whip-smart friend of mine from the Chicago days named David Cromer, who has since become a very successful Broadway director, had a musical called Adding Machine at the Minetta Lane Theater downtown. It was a great show, and I ended up replacing a guy, the handsome Jeff Still, for a couple of months. It was such a savory musical, easily the best thing I saw during my time in New York besides Young Frankenstein. It boasted incredibly original music by Joshua Schmidt, as well as a succinctly scripted book, adapted by Schmidt and Jason Loweth from the 1923 play by Elmer Rice. Once again, my Chicago theater community was paying dividends, this time in the form of an exceptional musical in New York City. Especially exciting because I had been given to understand that if one can make it there, then one can make it anywhere. Right before New York, I had been cast in another indie movie called Patriotville, a fine title later changed to the terrifically generic Taking Chances. Rob Corddry was the main bad guy. He played the mayor of this town, and I was his sheriff. Now, I was a huge fan of Rob's from The Daily Show, and I was really quite starstruck to meet him and subsequently work with him. We had so much fun together, we two white jackasses. It was really the first time I learned that I could substantially improvise, as it was the first project I had worked on where they wanted us to make up funny stuff to augment the script. Rob and I did, along with the rest of the cast, including the resplendent Justin Long and Missy Pyle. And, oh my God, he made me break, which is also known as cracking up, so hard. That guy is so wickedly smart and funny, which is now even more common knowledge since he's brought Children's Hospital into our lives. I really hit it off with Rob, and we became good friends. Later on, when I was in New York, he sent me the first scripts for Children's Hospital and was hinting pretty heavily that he wanted to see if Megan would be interested in playing the role of Chief, which of course she did. She read it. At the time it was a web series, like 5 or 10 episodes. She said, "I don't care what it is, this is the funniest thing I've read in years. I want to do this next." So thank Providence we both got involved with Children's Hospital. Casting directors after George Lopez had begun to say to me, "I saw you on George Lopez. I didn't know you do comedy." Again, it's as though they were saying, "I didn't know you specialized in identifying precious gemstones." I said, "Yeah, I perform entertainment. That's what I do. Comedy is included in that." Even Megan wasn't always considered a person who quote-unquote, does comedy, even after Will and Grace, because she was from the theater and not a sketch or improv background. It was unbelievable. Now, I had known Amy Poehler way back in the early 90s in Chicago, and we had remained friends across the years. Through Amy and Rob Corddry, I knew of the Upright Citizens Brigade, or UCB, theater in New York. I called up Amy and said, "Where do I start? What class do I take? What do I do?" And she said, "Well, there's a couple of shows that we do that are specially designed for actors to play in, and you don't need to know the ways of improv. Come on down." The percentage of comedy talent that comes to light today through the pipeline of the UCB is staggering. My first performance of a show they call Ass Cat included an improv cast that will blow the mind of any comedy nerd listening to this today. The show was hosted by Amy, Seth Meyers, and Horatio Sands, who then played in the scenes with Jessica St. Clair, Jason Mantzoukas, Rob Hubel, Lennon Parham, Scott Adsit, John Lutz, Tammy Sager, Brian Stack, Miriam Tolan, Paul Scheer, Christina Gauzes, Tim Meadows, Chris Gethard, Bobby Moynihan, and Jack McBrayer, for crying out loud, and I'm sure I'm even forgetting a couple. So, during my time in New York in 2007, I started doing these shows with this insane bunch of talents, and that was it. Megan came around as well, and suddenly, poof, we both did comedy. Between the UCB and Corddry and Children's Hospital, both Megan and I were suddenly welcomed into this community of comedy people. They hailed from the UCB Theater and also from a show from the 90s called The State, as well as tried-and-true institutions like Second City, Improv Olympic, and The Groundlings. All of these people with whom I had done comedy shows in New York moved out to L.A. at the same time that Megan and I moved back home, so suddenly everything funny was being cast from this pool of chucklesmiths that we had sort of stumbled into. Fortunately, they welcomed us with open arms. It's a very nurturing community, unlike other artistic cliques. Looking at you, Oscar winners. There's not a lot of competition happening, so much as people stating, "Hey, I'm going to do a show, and I'm going to need 8 of you." I'm thankful I know this circle of the best, funniest, filthiest people, because I always have the best quality to choose from. In 2008, I'd just gotten back from New York, and my first audition was for a one-line part in some movie George Clooney was producing. I'd worked with him on that live ER, and he was super friendly to me. He had wanted to cast me in a small role in his movie Leatherheads, but I had had a conflict. He's known for, among other obvious things, this crazily heroic talent for remembering everybody. I saw him at a party 7 or 8 years after ER, and he remembered that we had stood around a big pot of soup backstage, singing The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald together. It had been chilly and breezy in the soundstage because they had the enormous elephant doors open, and a bunch of actors and crew standing around a steaming kettle of chowder had just felt very maritime to us. When I saw him at this party years later, he pointed at me and said, "Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald." And I said, "Well, do I blow you now, or should we step into a more private chamber?" Although George denied me the opportunity to provide him with an oral pleasuring upon that particular occasion, I decided I'd go read for this new film anyway, as I'd found out Grant Heslov was directing and I knew he was an ace. I went in to read for this one-line part, and it was just the fucking casting hallway from hell. The role was small and not great, so the assembled talent was not the finest crop of produce one might have hoped to assemble. I had prepared a bit with a pair of glasses that I was planning to impishly remove before pronouncing my one line. It was just on tape for the casting lady, and it wasn't even the lady, actually. It was the lady's assistant. Unimpressed by my terrific bit, she said, "Are you going to do that with your glasses? Don't do that." To which I said, You know, I've got this one line. This is the bit I prepared. I'm just going to do my bit. So I did my bit. I stood my meager ground and pulled my glasses off to say the line, and I went away, and I never heard anything further from them. A couple months later, Megan and I were vacationing up in Calistoga in the Napa Valley wine country. Out of the blue, I got a call from my agent. Hey, you got that Clooney job, and your first scene is in Puerto Rico night after tomorrow. I said, oh, the one line thing? Jesus, okay. They said, but the good thing is that George Clooney is playing the lead. He'll be in your scene with your one line. Well, that was sounding better. The film business can be hilarious in that one day you're totally unemployed, on vacation in a remote California town, and the next, a production can send a car for you to scoot you over to San Francisco so you can fly to Puerto Rico at the drop of a hat. So I flew to Puerto Rico, and I got hustled right into a trailer to be dolled up. There was a kind of buzz around the base camp, like something extra exciting was going on. I finished hair and makeup and put on my 80s army fatigues, and I went into the room in a school where we were shooting, and would you looky here. My scene was with George Clooney and also these two other guys, Kevin Spacey and Jeff Bridges, and me, just the four of us. I thought, well, shit, I'm glad I went to that stupid one-line audition. If I ever record an audiobook, this'll make a good story. The film was The Men Who Stare at Goats, and I ended up in a good portion of the movie as a private in a platoon of psychic soldiers. Mainly, I got to stand there at attention while Jeff Bridges talked to us a whole bunch. Then we improvised a session of exploratory dance with him. If you enjoy the man's voice and demeanor half as much as I do, then you can understand how I was about as jubilant as a pig in effluvia to find myself in this freak-out of a job. I felt like a valued scout in a troop being led by George, Jeff, and director Grant Heslov. Clearly, the moral in this story was to always remember before turning my nose up at a one-liner that it could result in the unsurpassable delight of dancing with Jeff Bridges. Right about then, in the fall of 2008, the word was going around town that they were making a spin-off of The Office, and Amy Poehler was set to play the lead. Megan and I were major fans of The Office and watched it religiously. I would often remark, if I'm going to make it, if I'm ever going to get my shot, it's going to be on a show like this, in a part like Rain's. I had known Rainn Wilson for several years. We met in the late 90s, reading against each other for weird guy in the basement parts. I had always liked him, as he's such a smart, funny, sweet guy, not to mention he also comes from the theater. We had become buddies just from seeing each other at auditions so much when he got a great part on Six Feet Under for a string of episodes. I believe this was when the world in general really noticed him, and I thought, as we all do when such a thing occurs, excellent. Well thrown, Wilson. Score one for the good guys. Then, not long after that, he won his role on The Office. The mighty, transcendent role of Dwight Schrute, a portrayal which I am certain nudged the earth at least a quarter degree farther off her axis. My adoration blossomed even more when Rain commissioned an oak trestle table from me in the style of Gustav Stickley, and then insisted on paying me 50% more on top of my suggested price, a number which had been admittedly too friendly. A scholar, a sweetheart, a gentleman, and a clown of the highest order. Hence, when the word came down about Amy's new show starting up, I thought, you've got to be fucking kidding me. I've got to get on this show. Allison Jones. I wish you could hear the chorus of angels when her name is recited, as I do. one of LA's most top-drawer casting directors. Her IMDb page is gobsmacking, especially for comedy. Had originally called me in years earlier to audition for the role of Michael Scott, the lead of The Office, among many other things over the years. By God, she brought me in for Parks and Rec. The creators of the show, Greg Daniels and Mike Schur, were initially reading me for a different role named Josh, and the material was just so funny and so right on the money for my sense of humor. Megan was coaching me in our kitchen, as was our habit, and we were saying, "This is it. This writing? Oh my God. This is it. Don't fuck this up, fat boy." We don't pull any punches in the kitchen. I had been into Reed with the producers and some writers, and we were getting along great when we arrived at a hilarious day in hindsight. They had two guys come in to shoot scenes with Rashida Jones, a chemistry read, to determine how well two actors play together. The two guys were me and Adam Scott. I had known Adam for about 8 years and was a big fan, and I thought, oh, great. Me and Adam Scott up for the guy who gets to kiss Rashida. He's devilishly handsome and charming and funny. I'm, what, dry? Husky? Even my mom would cast him over me. I knew the producers liked me. I could tell they somehow thought I was special, and the feeling was powerfully mutual. A couple of weeks went by before I got the inevitable call. Sure enough, NBC had literally said to Mike and Greg, "We asked you for someone in the neighborhood of Aaron Eckhart, a very attractive neighborhood. We asked you for handsome, and you hand us Nick Offerman?" No. And Greg and Mike said, "Okay, you're right. He is really unattractive. But we really want Nick on the show. We have this other part we wrote, the part of Amy's boss, so we'd like to put Nick in that part. His name is Ron Swanson." Greg and Mike had called my agent and told us about the Aaron Eckhart news, which was not unexpected, but still crushing. I tried not to let it get to me. I had gone to Big Five Sports to buy a jock strap, as I have been known to do of a Tuesday, and I was in their parking lot when I got the call that it was over with the role of Josh. I went inside and glumly bought a pack of Athletic Supporters. When I returned to the parking lot 20 minutes later, I got the next call. "But we're trying to put you in this other part of Amy's boss." Okay. Crisis averted for the moment. Now let's get these jock straps home to Megan. NBC said to Mike and Greg, "Look, we love Nick. Historically, we love to test him for pilots and then not cast him. I mean, let's be real. He's not handsome. But anyway, that boss guy should be older." They then ended up putting me through 4 more months of sporadic auditions along with every other guy in town. They looked at old guys, fat guys, skinny guys, even handsome guys, even guys with chicken pox. Love hot dogs. You name it. Everybody and their dad read for that part. NBC expanded the search as wide as they possibly could, and then slowly narrowed it again until it was finally back down to just me and Mike O'Malley, a splendorous actor, hilarious comedian, and fantastic guy. I didn't know he was going to be there, as I had only received a call from my agent saying, "Okay, Amy has moved here from New York. They want you to come in tomorrow and go on tape for the network one last time, improvising with Amy, and this will be the last time." As you may have surmised, I went. I stepped out of the elevator, and there sat O'Malley. My heart sank to see a hilarious and charming, proven comedy veteran sitting there. They put both of us on tape with Amy, improvising a couple of Ron and Leslie scenarios, and we went home to wait. After all that, 5 months total, I found out the next day that I had gotten the job. And not only had I gotten the job, but they hadn't even turned in O'Malley's tape to NBC. At the end of all that network hand-wringing, Mike and Greg had obstinately only turned in my tape, which is what I believe the kids today would call a baller move. It was Mike Schur who called me with the news, and I'm not ashamed to admit that I cried. I cried like a little baby boy who has just dropped his bacon slice in a pile of cow shit. I said, "Listen, Mike, please keep talking to me, and I am so happy, but I'm just going to cry while we're talking." And I just openly sobbed for like 20 minutes while he told me this story. 3 years earlier, I had auditioned for a small guest star part on The Office. He was one of the five people in the room that day, and I didn't even know it. I didn't even know that I'd met him. He'd wanted me for that role, but I had a scheduling conflict and couldn't do it. Well, he liked something about me, so he went home and wrote my name on a yellow post-it note and adhered it to the bottom of his computer monitor, where it remained for 3 years until they were creating Parks and Rec. And he said, among other things, "I want this guy on the show." I mean, come on, after reading this fucking interminable chapter about casting in Hollywood, all of the bullshit, to then have that happen to me after 12 years in town? Megan immediately hit the nail on the head when she said, "If you'd gotten any of that other less perfect stuff, you never would have gotten this. Everything happened for the reason that you were meant to get this job." All I can say is that I'm glad I stuck it out without getting sour, and I am so grateful for the opportunity to work with a collection of the nicest and smartest and funniest people I've come across. And also Jim O'Hare, who plays Jerry Gergich on the program. Having borne the pain of so many ugly casting stories firsthand, and having heard secondhand of so many more traumatic, soul-crumbling rejections, I am left with no choice now but to turn squarely into the bright sun, take a deep breath, and mind my manners as hard as I can. Let your freak flag fly. When a director, producer, or casting director reads a script, he or she then imagines their ideal actor for each role, just like anybody does when reading a book. You imagine Aragorn for yourself, and maybe yours looks like Viggo Mortensen, or maybe yours looks like your dad, or Screamin' Jay Hawkins, or Gregory Peck. When anyone reads any paginated material containing characters, then that person is required to envision the characters in some way. In casting, then, one is invariably going to develop an idea of what's right, as in, what are the right attributes, or what is the right look, or Mark Wahlberg is so not right for this, or you know who's right for the role of Susan? Molly Shannon. When you are auditioning for a role, you're essentially presenting your own opinion of the character's attributes, your choices, as rendered through the presentation of your own body and voice, through performance, to some people who will almost certainly have differing opinions from your own. And that's before you can even begin to address the matter of your skill level and your ability to communicate your opinion effectively. When I first got to Chicago, I was immediately confronted with the harsher side of the business. I got hooked up with a sweet but tough agent named Marla Garland, who undertook the gentle guidance of my fledgling efforts. I started out auditioning for plays, commercials, and the very occasional TV show or film, and almost immediately, casting people started pigeonholing me. "You're a farmer. You're a plumber. You're going to play a lot of blue-collar stuff." I was fresh out of college, all bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and full of piss and vinegar, so I thought, "A plumber? Go fuck yourself. I am amazing. I'm going to play an old lady, then an opium-addicted elf, then I'm going to play a stick and shove it up your ass, bitch." Apparently, I used to engage in some pretty tough thinking. Marla tried to calm my ire and explain that these things take time and that eventually people would see that I was more than a plumber. But I was not to be mollycoddled by Marla. I was so bent on vindication that I had a headshot taken with a huge foam latex cock from the Defiant production of Big Mother in my hands and sent it to everybody in town. An audacious statement of defiance, the meaning of which no one had any fucking idea. A lot of them thought I was trying to be funny, which I suppose was also what I was trying to do to an extent. I did much better in the theater than anywhere else. After a couple of years, I became better at acting, reaching the level of intermediate, and I started getting film roles, which was exciting because there weren't that many films coming through Chicago, maybe 4 or 5 a year. I quickly learned that any kind of pandering was the wrong idea, but that it was important to simply be myself through the whole casting process. If I just presented myself as sincerely as possible, that was the best way to have a chance of getting hired. And by God, it seemed to work. 19 times out of 20, they're just not looking for you. And you have to learn to not take it personally. If the people are nice and you're prepared, then you can tell when they think you're good, and you can also tell when they think you're not good. There's a certain level of trial and error to auditioning. And you must simply try to continue to learn to behave in the way you did when they made you feel that they thought you were good. You also learn what mannerisms turn off a room and then try to subsequently avoid those behaviors. Insincerity, especially chipper insincerity, will close down a room faster than ripping a crisp fart. The discharge of which will also, I can assure you, take some of the air out of your credibility. Save it for church. By the time I left Chicago, I was depending upon a few casting directors who were putting more and more faith in me, and having me come in for increasingly great stuff, swinging for the fences. Sure, I struck out most of the time, but that's how it goes. They were hoping, along with me, that I would get lucky and connect with one of the pitches thrown at me, and I am very grateful that they saw something unique enough in me to keep sending me up to bat. You really cannot begin to do even remotely well as an actor without casting directors who put their faith in you. And once they do, so long as you continue to do a good job, they will keep bringing you back time and time again. The few ladies in Chicago who championed me really got me off on the right foot. And after 4 years of their benevolence in that magnificent town, I had amassed a very healthy resume. That is precisely why, when I tried to transition my song and dance to L.A., I had such a shitty pill to swallow, because nobody was really interested in theater work. Some few were, and I think that's why they are the best, or the least lazy, casting professionals, because they have the wherewithal to examine and utilize the great pool of talent that exists in the small quality theater productions that LA can offer. Other than those exceptional casting pros, nobody really cared that I had done these plays. I was still able to do a good job in my auditions, but I'd lost my Chicago advantage, where people more often than not would have seen my work on stage. With or without a leg up, casting is just a brutal process for the initiate. They might be looking at 200 people or only 20 people, but either way, there will almost always be a few good people competing with you. Even if you do a great job, it might not matter, because maybe they want a taller guy or a more muscular guy or a handsomer guy, and you just have to learn to bear that simple hardship. The better things began to go, the better the auditions I got, until I began occasionally testing for series regular parts on TV pilots. A pilot test is the most exciting lottery ticket one can lay hands on, because a TV pilot will generally look at unknown talent more seriously than a film will. Therefore, a person can suddenly find him or herself with a legitimate shot at a show like Friends or Girls or Mad Men or Parks and Recreation, shows that value their performer's relative obscurity, upon which fresh characters can be painted. So imagine you're living in L.A. in some version of squalor, chasing your dream of working on great material as an actor, whether you hope to make people laugh or cry or shit, or all three at once, my dream, and I'll walk you through the emotionally vacillating steps of a pilot audition process. First of all, these are coveted auditions, so you're a lucky son of a bitch if you are getting maybe 12 to 16 new pilot scripts to peruse. Your agent has managed to get you auditions for the casting directors of three shows, let's say as an alcoholic cop in one, a chubby stoner working in a Milwaukee donut shop in another, and in a third, you run a low-rent law firm representing primarily softcore porn stars. That third script is clearly exploitative and terrible, so you reluctantly pass. There goes 33% of your hopes. The alcoholic cop part will string you along, stroking your imagination for three or four auditions, but ultimately break your heart when it's offered outright to Jeremy Piven, who was the guy who played that asshole agent on Entourage, which was a show that was on cable. I told you, it's a tough business. So, a few weeks into pilot season, you are left with one basket into which you must gingerly place your hopeful eggs. All of your eggs. In the one basket of the chubby Milwaukee stoner who is named Blowfish. You have been in for the casting director, and she had liked you already, so you come back in again for her, as well as the writer and maybe a producer or two. They really like you. You get the jokes, and they let you know that they're really enjoying your comprehension of their humor. You are elated. Holy shit, this seems to be really happening. You come back a third time to read for all of them, as well as the director this time. After the reading, which is once again full of enthusiastic laughter, they tell you in a conspiratorial tone that they really, really want you to be their Blowfish. The show's creator confides, "Nobody's even coming close to getting the writing the way you are, and your voice is exactly like what I was hearing when I wrote it. Simpatico. Splendid. Seems like it's in the bag." Now it's time for your network test. This means the network executives need to scrutinize you for themselves so that they may hold your performance and your resume and appearance and demeanor and personality up against the statistical charts in their minds, a schematic of the current fashions in the zeitgeist. Sure, he's a good actor, but will the Maxim readers dig him? They have already chosen to spend a lot of money on the writing and the premise of their show, their fish hook, and now they're hoping to choose actors who will, one way or another, be as irresistible to the national audience as juicy nightcrawlers upon said hook. This makes these execs simply the worst audience for whom you will ever perform. They are bankers and accountants, and they are not in the room to be entertained by you. They are there to judge your worth as bait, without sentiment. They are Upper East Side ladies shopping at Barney's, and you are but one of several pairs of fancy shoes being paraded in front of them for possible purchase. It's the most exciting step in the sequence that can lead to booking a job on a television show, and easily the most unpleasant. Before you can even get into the room, however, there are a few hurdles over which you must handily spring. Firstly, the night before the test, you hear from your people that there will be three other guys auditioning against you. Two of them you've become very familiar with from seeing them at the recent string of Blowfish readings, but the third remains a mystery. Your agent tells you that the network is probably bringing in a ringer. A ringer is an actor who boasts some sort of impressive television resume, indicating proven and dependable chops. A person of whom the network can say, "Well, we didn't like any of the new guys, but the kid from Freaks and Geeks is hilarious if we're in a pinch." For the last week, your agent has been hungrily discussing your quote with the network's business affairs office. This means that the network is trying to leverage the cheapest possible price for your services, whilst your agent fulminates with whatever ammunition he or she can brandish to win you, and him or her to the tune of 10%, the fattest possible episodic salary. Your deal is made before you arrive on the day of the test. So before you can take your turn to stand in judgment before the bankers, you must sign all of your contractual paperwork. The pragmatic reason for this preemptive bargaining is so that, once the network wants you, once they are on the hook, I must have Vanderbeek, bring me the juice. James cannot then counter with, okay, swell, I would like $37 million. The problem with this deal-signing step lies in the weakness of the human will, certainly mine, anyway. Let's say this is your first time and it's one of the big networks, say ABC. Perhaps by now you have greeted the other two guys in competition and also discovered that the mystery third man is in fact the second funniest geek from Freaks and Geeks. You arrive at the equivalent of the network's Death Star and are led sedately into a room just short of being bound and blindfolded. Alone, you are seated at an intimidatingly vast conference table, where a lawyer from business affairs quickly walks you through the signing of a thick sheaf of papers, which is when you begin to see the numbers that make you weak. You multiply the episodic salary, say 17,500, by the number of episodes, 22, then you multiply that by the number of years named in the terms of the contract, 7. Your vision immediately begins to swim with dreams of acreage in Illinois' idyllic Sangamon River Valley, and a brand new pickup truck and some of those fancy jeans like McConaughey wears. It could not be made any more plain to you that your shitty life will be 100% salvaged if this 137-page lottery ticket to which you are applying your several signatures hits. And it doesn't help matters that you are staring ravenously at 1 in 4 odds. So your head has completely flown out the window, and it is now that you are invited into the room to perform your rendering of Blowfish for the network comptrollers. Sure, there are a few friendly faces, like the casting director and the show's writer-creator, who are also busy shitting little green apples of their own. Especially the writer, as he or she watches helplessly while the corporation tries to thread disparate baits onto the hook that he or she has so lovingly and painstakingly crafted. Let's try this leech. Okay. Now the worm. Okay. Nice. Now bring in the wood grub. Oh, wow, I like this grub. I like it a lot. Do we have any other grubs? Can we look at some stink bait? Mainly, this audience is hilariously unfriendly. One guy is just typing into his laptop the whole time, never even looking up at you. One lady is holding up a centerfold of Will Smith, looking at it with one eye and you with the other. Three besuited versions of Hugo Weaving as Agent Smith in The Matrix fix their steely gazes upon you, without apparently comprehending you as a human being who is attempting to weave a clown-like diversion for their enjoyment. The casting director gamely tries to laugh at the right moments, generously sprinkling what I call the courtesy laugh, as does the writer, when he or she is not vomiting into his or her stainless steel water bottle. Needless to say, it's a tough room. You are dismissed. You suddenly come to, finding yourself behind the wheel of your vehicle, blindly driving while replaying the audition over and over in your mind's eye, coming up with way better versions than the one you just laid, slick and steaming, on the floor of the judgment room. Speeding towards the comforts of home, or the coffee shop or the pub, you manage to keep your compulsive examinations of your cell phone to only every 24 to 28 seconds. Finally, after a couple of excruciating hours, your agent calls. This is it. Okay, you did great, but I'm sorry, it's not going your way. They didn't hire anybody, and they're not sure what they're going to do. They're talking about retooling the character a little bit, and unfortunately for you, I also think they're now going to go after a person of color for Blowfish. I heard Isai Morales. Again, I aver, do not get into this business if you can help it. The scenario I have just described is not only quite par for the course, but one is considered incredibly lucky just to have the opportunity to have one's guts ripped out so. Remember that on every level in this business, you are an artist trying to get a job at which you will be paid sometimes incredibly well to perform or display your respective art to as large an audience as possible. If you are a purist who would simply like to create artwork, then you can do that wherever you are, beholden to no one without ever going through bullshit of this brand. If you dive into the pool of sharks that is commercial entertainment, then you will forever be butting heads with the corporate interests that are trying to use your art to sell sandwich condiments. And that is invariably going to be an uphill battle. When I first moved to L.A., John Cusack was coming by our house to pick up a mutual friend so they could go play basketball. When he arrived, we literally heard him coming down the block because he was screaming at someone on his phone. He blew in, shook hands, apologizing with, "Sorry guys, my agent," collected our friend, and they were gone. Pat Roberts and I looked at each other and said, "Let's always remember this. You can even be John Cusack, and you're still just trying to get what you want, while the business is trying to get what they want from you." Something I continue to learn about folks, really people in every business, but this one specifically, is that we're all just people, people whose wants are often incredibly disparate. Knowing this and remembering this helps to keep the bitterness from encroaching on any territory in my soul. If you are as big a fool as I, and you can't help but take a crack at a potential dream life of whiskers, scotch whiskey, and steak, at a job where you are paid to eat bacon on a regular basis, then here are some tips on auditioning, which you can choose to heed as you wish or ignore completely. Number one, perform wherever and whenever you can. Theater, improv, sketch, stand-up, whatever floats your boat. Practice will keep you sharp, and you never know when you'll happen upon the right place and time for opportunity to strike. Sure, maybe everybody tells you you're cute anyway, or you're hilarious, but if you also continue to hone your skills in performing, it's only going to up your confidence level in the room. Number two, do more than perform. Work backstage at the theater, or get work on a film set, or even a music video. Watch the masters at work, studying all of their disparate techniques for effective storytelling. Think about different ways in which you might play a scene if you were thrown on stage or in front of the camera. If you can help out at any auditions behind the camera, jump at the chance. Run the video camera or help out by reading the scene material aloud with the actors. You will be guaranteed an inordinate amount of invaluable lessons from the parade of hopefuls on what to do and what not to do, I promise. Number three, be yourself. Megan talks about this a lot as well. When you read the audition scene, don't ever think, "What do I think these people want to see?" Because that just weakens your strength, what makes you special. The only thing you have going for you is you and your unique take. What makes you and your friends laugh? That is the right way to approach any material. Megan spent years trying out different weird and funny voices at auditions, and the majority of the productions thought she was a crazy lady, until someone saw the vein of golden talent running through her hills and gave her the opportunity to create Karen Walker on Will and Grace. She never would have achieved that triumph had she lacked the guts to persevere in delivering her brand of strangeness. Number four, be prepared. Don't be a lazy fuck. Know your lines. Do your homework. Number five, eat red meat. Producers like a pelt with a healthy glow. Number six, don't dress like a cop when you're auditioning for a cop part. You don't need a cowboy hat when you audition for Bonanza, You're never gonna score points that way. Think about it. Well, he was only okay. I mean, he didn't really know his lines, but you know, that was a pretty sweet fucking stethoscope and set of scrubs he had on. Let's give him another look-see. The best outfit you can wear is confidence. Number 7. This is the most important, and it goes for life as well as auditions. Make your life happy.